Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Country Vine for May 19th, 2024. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me as always. Welcome, Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, excited about tonight's show. In about 20 minutes, we're going to have one of the most intriguing guests I think we've probably really ever had, and it's Dr. Alan Lichtman of American University, who created the 13 Keys to the Presidency back in the early 80s. We're going to talk to him about the keys and how that works. Now, of course, everybody's asking him, who's going to win this time? And, we may touch around that, but we're going to try to go a little deeper into it because, obviously, things could change between now and November. But Dr. Lichtman, he goes on all kinds of networks and shows, and for him to give us time tonight on the Kudzu Vine, we are so honored and excited about getting to discuss the presidential race and past races and what have you with him. But until then, we got a few topics to talk about. Later on, we're hoping to get to a little more of our buy-sell hold with the vice presidential candidates on the Republican side. But right off the bat, we did want to start off with the really fireworks in some ways, I guess you might say, Wednesday. There was, of course, a lot of going back and forth about what kind of debates there be, how many debates there be. Would the League of Women Voters, the debate on commissions, who was going to get to help structure the debates for 2024? And seemingly out of nowhere, the Biden campaign said, this is what we propose, a debate in June between the presidential candidates, a vice presidential debate in July, and I want to say that last debate between the presidential candidates is in September, but they, basically sent out a structure. Joe Biden challenged Donald Trump. Donald Trump accepted pretty much that same day. Catherine, how surprised were you at the timeline on how fast this thing came together?
It was pretty quick. All of a sudden, it was resolved. There wasn't a big battle back and forth, which we've seen in the past. So that's good, And I'm happy with the timing on the timing on the debates. I think it's good that they're happening earlier. I think that was one of Biden administration's expectations or requests or demands. I'm not sure exactly how to refer to them. But I think it looks like a good debate schedule. I'm sure we'll get into more details as we move forward. But I think it's good.
Yeah, the one part of it I think is really interesting, Tim, is that VP debate, and that was probably talked about the least, the Republican convention will be in July. I'm not sure the exact dates in Milwaukee. I know I could look them up, but I don't have that in front of me. And then that debate is in July. So if Donald Trump waits till, pretty much the week before the convention to pick his VP nominee, and that person also has to plan out a speech to introduce themselves to the American public, that's really going to compress that individual's timeline to get ready to meet the American public in such a way, right?
Yeah, that's probably something that he hadn't thought of, and it'll be one of the things he complains about, because he's already started complaining about every bit of this. I think they'd rather see the VP debate in late August instead of late July, but it apparently is tentatively on for late July, and I say tentative because I still think it's an iffy proposition whether or not these debates even happen. So.
Yeah, well, we can get to that. One interesting proposition I would like to see is Kamala Harris is not afraid to debate, and she actually could use all the chances she could get to raise her profile, raise her standing with voters before 2028. And, I mean, she could possibly volunteer to just debate, you know, hey, you're thinking about five people? I'll debate them all, one at a time. And, of course, that would give her tons of exposure. And given how well she did in the, you know, the confirmation hearings of, I believe it was it the first justice, was it Gorsuch or was it Brett Kavanaugh, that she was, you know, did such a good job in kind of cross-examination, I guess you'd say. Y'all remember which one it was?
Yeah.
Which one?
I'm not sure which one it was.
I want to say it was Gorsuch, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. So that was really, I think, key to her, you know, raising her profile before the presidential election. Well, Catherine, a lot of people after this thing kind of fleshed itself out by Thursday, Friday, they were just saying the Biden campaign just ran a masterclass on how to negotiate a debate, played into Trump's machismo, to where he's going to say yes to any challenge before, you know, anybody had a chance to look at anything, hit him at a moment in which he was so focused on one of his many extracurricular trials and just got exactly the format they wanted in many ways, right?
Yeah, I think the fact that there's going to be no audience was a big win for Biden. And a loss for former President Trump. I was surprised when I read that they agreed to that. And maybe, like Tim said, maybe it won't happen. But no audience is a big bonus for because of the volatility of the Trump voters and how riled up they can get. They could be quite a disruption. Even though they try to keep everybody quiet in those debates, not always possible. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting, a very small thing, but that they're going to be using microphones that can be turned off so that if one of the two debaters is interrupting, they can turn off their microphone.
Yeah, I think that was actually a more effective thing given what happened in the debate in Cleveland, the first debate in 2020. If Chris Wallace is probably going, where were those turn-off mics when I was having to corral those two? It was originally Trump gets out of control and then Biden felt like he had to match that vitriol, and it just digressed into probably the worst as far as, you know, the American voter learning anything debate in American history. But now as far as the crowd, now one thing I've always thought is, in 2020, that middle debate got canceled, and that would have been the town hall. Now if you could get voters that were either maybe undecided or voters that were kind of middle of the road, that kind of, you know, maybe they were soft or somehow they wanted to come up with reflective, thought-based questions about issues that affect the American people. And you could have those questions asked to the each candidate, and then that candidate asked that person's questions instead of the crosstalk as much. I think that would be something that possibly could get a better debate out of, in particular, Donald Trump. Because, I mean, Joe Biden has a track record of 2012 and 2008 MVP debates where he was very civilized and debated like a normal politician, and Donald Trump did a version of what he did in 2020 and 2016 against Hillary Clinton. So that's just his modus operandi. Tim, you touched on something. I think we got to go with this. That you think the debates might not happen. Why do you think that, and if they don't happen, or they don't happen in this format? How does it devolve?
Well, it would devolve because Trump, in particular, would look for some reason not to do it. He didn't debate any of the people running against him in the primary. Perhaps he didn't think he had to or anything. And just because he jumped up and said, oh, yeah, I'll debate you, blah, 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 they're going to find everything in the world to complain about. And this already started. They don't like the format that there's going to be no audience. He likes to play to an audience. He really don't like the fact that at least at the CNN debate, they're going to be seated. And he doesn't like that at all. He wants Biden to stand up for 2 hours to see, I think, if it exhausts him or something.
Up for 2 hours?
Well, he's trying to play the macho man. He's doing that. And he also wants to stalk around and stomp around and holler and interrupt and do all of that, those things that he's done before that he's not going to be able to do this time. I think both candidates like this, though, that the Presidential Debate Commission has basically been abandoned. They all, though, disagree on everything. Trump didn't even want the debates when they were announced they were going to happen. And Trump wants 2 full hours. Another thing, I don't think Trump likes this in particular because the debate commission won't be doing the debates. They're not going to be aired everywhere. The CNN debate, for instance, will be on cable. And it'll be in a TV studio, too. And Trump doesn't like that. So we'll see if he's going to do that. But I do have to remind everybody, and I'm sure y'all are not going to agree with me on this, but the reason Biden came forward first, his campaign feels that it needs a reset. His campaign is struggling to take control of the narrative on the economy, democracy versus autocracy, immigration, foreign policy. And if Trump has anything he wants, it's to turn attention away from his trials. But I think in doing this, Biden, it's a great risk and a great reward. He's risking a lot by doing this right now. Because if he were to fall flat, even though I don't think there's any way he will, then that'd probably be the ball game. I know y'all may not believe that either, but.
Well, I'll say this. I think that one thing that I don't believe the narrative. I mean, I'm seeing more and more, people saying that these polls are just not right. And no one really believes that these polls that we're seeing, like the New York Times one that came out this past week of some of the swing states, the numbers are just off. Some of the best experts in Nevada, for instance, said, that number is so far off, it's just laughable. I mean, John Ralston, Alex Diaz, all the experts in Nevada politics. But the one thing I will say this is Joe Biden and the Joe Biden campaign know that Donald Trump was going to, use that as a beating stick if they didn't debate. If he ended up being the one, like Donald Trump said, let's debate in a cage at a Trump rally, and then Joe Biden says, well, I don't want to debate in a cage at a Trump rally. Well, you're a chicken, and you're old, and you can't handle it. And it would just become the whole narrative. So this way, Joe Biden controls the narrative on the debates, which is super smart of the campaign. And now, no matter what it devolves into, his campaign, and he can say, we set these up first in a dignified manner, and Trump wanted no part of it. So now they can maybe not control the narrative completely, but have a lot of say in the narrative. Catherine, I know Tim said both of us, so I'll let you have a second on the same question.
I agree. I think this does give him control of the narrative, President Biden. And I think it shows that he's willing and interested in debating Trump. Whereas Trump just wants a Trump show. So I think it does help, you know, sort of ignite the campaign, the Biden campaign, a little bit. But we'll have to wait and see what Trump gets himself up to between now and. I am worried about the VP debate is it right after the Republican convention?
It would be very close. I mean, we probably need to get a calendar out and look at the dates. But
and
it's got to be
not,
really
and,
close.
Huh. And it's not even – and it's way ahead of the Democratic – of course, there's no question about the VP, the Democratic VP. So.
No.
That just seems like a little bit of a risk for the Republicans. But if they – whatever – just seems,
yeah. Well, I mean,
maybe that's
that
too
could,
early.
Yeah. Well, that could cause them to push the pick forward. Which, given how quickly Trump locked down the nomination, I mean, I think he could pick a VP candidate sooner. It would also give him another surrogate out on the trail. I mean, if he has a strong feeling about somebody, why not?
Yeah,
just
but
pull
what
the
if,
trigger.
What if there,
but
what if
he may not.
Something happened. Something could happen at the convention with, if there's enough, if people are unhappy with his choice. Something could happen.
Well,
I don't think it will
happen there.
I don't think it will. So.
But okay, Catherine, I agree. They could not be happy with his choice. But B, would they have the cojones to actually stand up to Trump to tell him?
No,
that
they
part
won't.
I'm very
yeah,
suspect of.
Okay. Okay, I stand corrected. I'm sorry. That's fine.
Well, it's just that those people have folded like cheap suits now for, going on nearly 8 years. But I mean, I will say this. There is a portion of the Republican electorate because even this past week, Nikki Haley got like 20% of the vote in Indiana. There was another state she did. Now, in West Virginia, she didn't do quite as well. But she did really well in those states, and that's just a placeholder for anybody but Trump. And that shows you that there is a portion of the electorate that doesn't like him. And, I mean, people are speculating that that's going to be the people that just don't vote for him, and it could be the margin of victory in several states. People are pointing to that factor. Well, so the debate set, Tim, you brought up a point, and it was a very important one. First debate, only on CNN. I mean, there's probably some mm-hmm. Republicans that have blocked CNN on their TV because they only look at Fox, OAN, and Newsmax. There's another debate, I think, on ABC. But these,
right.
That means there's going to be more choices. It's not going to be on PBS. It's not going to be on CNN. It's not going to be on all the news networks, all of the networks. What does that do to – and it's going to be in during summer vacation, a lot of these debates. What does this do to the possible viewing audience?
Well, I think the viewing audience might be down a little bit anyway because, dare I mention, the polls. But the polls have showed that most of the voters do not like either candidate, which I think works in Trump's favor, by the way. But if they don't like either candidate, perhaps they're not going to be tuning in. And there's another group, too. If RFK is running around 10% in the polls, he's left out. Because according to CNN, you need 15% in at least four polls to get on the debate stage. And he's not going to get there. And Trump and Biden certainly are not going to exceed and allow him in. It would raise his profile up to the level of them. So why would they let him in? They get nothing for letting him on the stage, and he's not going to be there. So then there's his supporters. He's accusing the Democrats and Republicans of colluding, by the way, to exclude him. I don't know where he's been, but I don't think Democrats and Republicans could collude on what day of the week it is right now. I don't expect a gigantic viewing audience like we've had with the debate commission where all the networks got in on it, you know, and watched it. It's really too bad, too, because I think we should be more civic-minded about such things, and it should be made easier for people to watch it, not easier to not watch it.
Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing. I want debates where people hear about real problems and they hear about real solutions or the impact of solutions and what that means, and decisions have to get made, and it's more problem-based. It's kind of like, you know, Vox Media, where they have explainers. You know, because obviously for Republicans, go ahead. And I know we're not going to get
debate.
That, Catherine. I have no,
we haven't had
I have
debates
no
like
thought
that
we're
ages.
Ever going to get that. Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying. I mean, if you could reimagine the things, you know, you would get something totally different. I mean, like, here's the thing. For Republicans, one of the number one issues is immigration. Fine. Let's get into that. If we restrict immigration to, like, no one practically, what does that mean for our society? Let's look at South Korea. How will America be different than South Korea? Explain that to everybody. Oh, well, it means this. Well, do we want that? Maybe they do. Maybe they don't. But you have to explain things like that. And you have to really look at the issues in a very analytical way. I know some people may not even be ready to handle that. But that's really where folks got to go. And will they? I'm very suspect of that. Well, let's get into another discussion right now. And we may have to put a pin in this, but we're going to go start on it anyway. It's really a two-parter. And we didn't get to discuss the first part of it a few weeks ago. But then Friday, it's really went on all week. There was a vote at the Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama, if they were going to unionize the Mercedes-Benz plant. Now, there was a similar vote in Chattanooga at the Volkswagen plant several weeks ago by 73%. It became the first union car manufacturing plant in the South in Chattanooga. And when I saw, they passed it by 73%, I really felt pretty optimistic that the one in Vance, Alabama, would pass. It failed. It failed by, I forgot the final total, but I want to say it was around 10%. It was a pretty solid percentage where I don't know that it's going to, you know, have any challenges that really mean anything. Tim, I think you've been probably a union member longer than the other two of us have, and I'm not even sure I've technically ever really been one because of the NEA. But tell us your thoughts on, I guess, the vote just this past week in Alabama.
Well, if we're just going, you didn't ask me to comment on the Volkswagen situation, so I won't. 30% of all auto plant jobs in this country now are in the South. The South has been a place that especially many foreign automakers have chosen because, number one, they give them big tax breaks just to locate here, and most importantly, cheap labor. By that, I mean non-union labor. This particular vote, you know, I thought it was going to pass too. Because for one thing, Alabama has the second highest percentage of union employees in the South. Might be something most people don't know, but they do. Almost 9% of the workforce in Alabama is unionized. But, of course, the South is historically the most anti-labor section of the country, and, you know, the UAW in particular has really been ramping it up down here. Everyone had high hopes for this election coming on the heels of that vote in Tennessee. And there are also more attempts in Alabama to organize other automakers over there that are ongoing right now. But I got to wonder, does this stall things a little bit? Unions have been on a winning streak lately, like we haven't seen in an awful long time. But one thing that happened there in Alabama, the governors of Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, they all joined forces earlier this year, especially after the Tennessee vote, to actively oppose union organizing in the South by legislating or whatever they had to do. A matter of fact, the governor of Alabama just signed legislation to make it harder for union organizing to happen. They lost 56-44, and I think basically they just scared them to death. They used the captive audience thing where you have to go to classes and sit there and get the company's end of it. They don't let the union in there at all, and on the grounds of the plant, they do not let any pro-union employees give out any union material at the gate or anywhere else unless they're off the property. And, the company really ramps it up. They really do. I've seen it happen in person. So it's tough that they lost this. I sure do hate it.
Yeah, given the narrative there, 44% actually the – sounding like a better and better number, given, the one-sided nature of the campaign. Catherine, Kay Ivey, Governor of Alabama, I sent it to y'all, and I sent it directly to you, too. I think I sent it to both of y'all, but I mentioned you. Kay Ivey said, don't turn Alabama into Detroit. Do you think that kind of rhetoric really swayed anyone, or was that just something she liked to say, that, don't turn our place into somewhere up north like those Yankees? I mean, you could almost hear the southern drawl in the printed words.
I'm not sure that one line, made a difference, but I think the whole campaign was, and like Tim said, all the company shenanigans all helped to defeat it. I was really surprised, too. I was also surprised to learn today that Alabama, I think this is what I read. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. Alabama manufactures the most cars in the country.
Of any single state, that's correct.
Yeah, and I think South Carolina's, closing in as well. And what I think that was is back, over 20 years ago now, they really recruited, I think first was that Mercedes-Benz plant. They gave away just unseen tax incentives to recruit that car manufacturer to Alabama years ago. And I think those tax incentives have just carried on year after year. And that's part of what they were talking about with the Alabama discount that the union membership used as a narrative. Which that's the thing is, like, I know that there was a bill in Georgia that some of the conservative Republican legislators have come after some of those tax incentive packages, and Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who most would say is pretty conservative himself, vetoed it. And I'll say this, I actually see both sides of that. I understand why you don't want to have all those tax packages that can really impact your tax base, your schools, your roads, your healthcare system, everything. But then if you don't have them, they're just going to go the next state over. And so really the states need to unionize and work together and basically say, let's not let state company A play state A off of state B, because that's all they're going to do. They're going to put, but if nobody gives those tax incentives or gives reasonable tax incentives that they all agree to, then those companies are going to have to choose where they want to be based on something else than just unfair giveaways to the citizens at stake.
You know, maybe people were too hopeful here based on the Volkswagen vote, but there was a couple of differences. Number one, this was their third shot in Chattanooga. It failed the previous two times. The first time it failed terribly. The second thing is that Volkswagen actually likes dealing with unions because they, you know, standardize everything industry-wide for them with their plants all over the world. They like doing that. So they stayed pretty much neutral in that union fight up there, whereas Mercedes actively, very actively, opposed the union campaign, you know, at the plant in Alabama. They sent some of their big shots, at least, you know, U.S. big shots in their U.S. division down there to do it, sent lawyers down, sent all of that down there. They threw everything at it but the kitchen sink. And like I said, if you were to go to your union meet, you had to do that on your own time and off the property. And it's pretty one-sided thing, and you know, they're different in different states, but Alabama takes that right to work stuff pretty seriously over there, and they fought it tooth and nail.
Yeah, and I want to ask y'all, and Catherine, I guess I'll go to you first, but Tim, I want you to answer this too. They're doing this vote as we're right in the middle of a presidential election in a state in which the Republican nominee is pretty popular in Alabama, and unions are seen as very democratic. Would this vote not fare better after a presidential campaign or not in the heat of a presidential campaign? Like, let's say this time next year, when it could be more about union or not union, not about where does this impact, you know, the political, you know, balance of things?
You know, I think the three of us in our, you know, circle of political friends are much more focused on the presidential campaign than most people. And I think it probably doesn't make a difference whether this vote was now or next year. I don't think that has anything to do with it. That's my opinion.
Jim, your thoughts?
Well, you know, we all know that if Donald Trump wins, that there probably won't be another union election over there. I mean, you know, like most of his ilk, he does not like organized labor. Now, he'll go out and give them a little bit of lip service to try to get them to vote for him. Unions are not going to have a good time if we lose this presidential election. So those folks there at that Mercedes-Benz plant, they might have got missed the only chance that they were going to get for a while if the election don't go as we hope in November. That's the main thing about this. They should have hit it while it was hot, while all these other places are organizing. Didn't they just see what all the big three automaker employees just got? The benefits and pay they just got is dwarfing what they're getting down there in Alabama, dwarfing it. You know, finally the VW employees realized that. That was a big selling point to them, but it hadn't made its way down to Central and South Alabama yet, has it?
No, and it's kind of sad for those employees, because to me, even more relevant than what Ford, Chevrolet, and Chrysler may have given their employees, a lot of these employees in Mercedes-Benz overseas in Germany, they are unionized. They do get all these benefits. They get government benefits like health care that's much more robust than America. So they're not getting what their very own Mercedes-Benz
colleagues are getting. And to me, that's kind of discriminatory, although Alabama employees, at least the 2,600 some of them that voted against the union, are allowing it to happen.
Yep.
Which, you know, I don't know. It seems like that would have been a bigger talking point. There's two more things I want to touch on this, and there's just really so much on this, but there's two more that I thought about. Tim, I got one for you, and I got one for you, Catherine. Tim, apparently Nick Saban owns a Mercedes-Benz dealership. And Nick Saban, now, he actually came from West Virginia where the coal miners union was strong. And I think he's actually been pro-union in some circumstances, but in this particular one, since he has ties to management at Mercedes-Benz, he actually helped, you know, in the campaign to defeat the union. Your thoughts on how much importance Nick Saban may have played?
Well, I'm sure it didn't help, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it did a lot to hurt either. You know, it's very funny that he would do that, but I guess he was thinking about his own pocketbook in this situation, and so that's the side of things he came down on.
Yeah. Well, and Catherine, the next point I have, and this actually goes as much to the Chattanooga plant vote as does the Alabama vote, but it does kind of play in. I saw a lot of videos of people talking about why they supported the union in Chattanooga, and then I saw the pictures of the folks that in Chattanooga and Alabama that voted for the union. And I would say that that looked like the folks voting for the union and supporting the union at both plants were probably more African-American than the electorate or the workforce as a whole at those plants. Is there a chance, unfortunately, that some people may have saw this in racial terms, like the unionization vote is more for people of color and the vote to stay non-union is more what, you know, the good old Southern white man does?
Oh, I think there's probably some – I mean, I think that's what Kay Ivey was dog whistling when she said, we don't want to be like Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean –
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of racial undertones to all this. But it's just unfortunate that people don't understand the advantages to joining a union and all the benefits that we all have gained from union organizing. I mean, we wouldn't work seven We would be working 6 days a week if it weren't for unions. We wouldn't have health care. I mean, all of us, not just union workers. So in some ways it's a fault of education and the teaching of history, in my mind.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that there may be more, you know, things to come out, and this may not be a dead discussion but a dormant one for now. As we move on to other things, and last week we did a buy-sell hold on several vice presidential nominees. We kind of made a list, although I feel like our list is still going to be insufficient, so we can always feel free to add as we have more time over this week and next. But the next one I guess we need to talk about is Tim Scott. I think in some of the betting markets, Tim Scott may be the betting favorite, although that may still be like under a quarter out of $10 because it's such a large field. But, Tim, buy, sell, hold on the VP nomination prospects of Tim Scott.
Well, he would be my choice if I were choosing the vice presidential candidate for Trump. He's a good speaker. He's charismatic. And he might actually help Trump some with black voters. But he might overshadow Trump. Trump wouldn't stand for that still, I think he's on the short list, David, so I'm going to buy him.
Okay. Catherine, buy, sell, hold, Tim Scott.
I'm going to say pretty much the same thing that Tim said. I'm buying him for pretty much the same reasons. I do worry that Trump won't pick him because he's, he's young and I mean, I don't know how old he is, but he's younger than Trump.
Politically young.
Yeah, and he's, a little bit captivating. He's got some charisma that's not all negative like Trump's is. So that might be a turnoff for Trump. But, yeah, I'm going to buy him.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of like, can we buy more than one or we just have to buy one? But definitely I'll say this. I don't think there's any way you could sell Tim Scott. Because, he did show a lot of fealty to Donald Trump. When he dropped out, he just basically, endorsed Trump immediately, campaigned for Trump, just, no pushback at all to Donald Trump whatsoever. He does bring diversity to the ticket, which the Republicans have lacked for many, many years. I'm trying to think, I guess, other than Sarah Palin. And I guess there was the Coolidge's vice president, Charles, and I'm forgetting his last name, who was Native American back in the 1920s. So we're talking 100 years ago. I guess that was, the other time where there was some diversity there. So
Charles Dawes.
Charles
Dawes was Coolidge's. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was Native American. I think that's the positives. I will say this. I'll go ahead and buy him as well, so I'm assuming we can buy maybe more than one if there's a decent chance, because I think he's going to stay on the short list. The two issues that I see, one could be the fact that he had that thing where does he have this girlfriend? Is the girlfriend real? Then he got engaged to the girlfriend, and it just seems kind of like an unknown. And I guess if they vet that out and it's just they kept everything private, then that's not going to be an issue. But if there's more there, that becomes that kind of tabloid issue that really pierces the filter, and people that don't necessarily follow politics, they really, may see, hey, that's my business. I'm interested in that. And that becomes a negative for him. And then the other possible negative, I think, is Tim Scott on a personal level, just as a human being, seems to have a pretty high likability factor in general, and in particular, in politician in 2020. And so there's a chance that Tim Scott's like the most likable candidate on the ticket, and that's probably going to be seen as a huge negative for Donald Trump. Well, right now, I am so excited to bring on to the show from American University, Dr. Alan Lichtman. Welcome, Dr. Lichtman.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes. Well, thanks for coming on the show tonight. We wanted to have you on because, obviously, we're all political observers. We have heard for many years about your 13 keys to the presidency.
Uh-huh.
So we wanted to talk about those. And I guess my first question was, have you noticed throughout the years of doing this since the early 80s, elections where certain keys are more predictive and other keys are less predictive all in an election?
Yeah. Well, here's the beauty of the keys. They are all unweighted. Each counts for one. There are 13. They're true-false questions that primarily gauge the strength and performance of the White House party. The problem when you weight keys is you create errors because the weighting has to be based on past elections, obviously, and the weighting can unpredictably change. So all my keys work in concert with one another, although it's certainly possible that one key could be significant enough that it triggers other keys. For example, the Vietnam War in 1960s triggered the incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson, to withdraw, losing the incumbency. It cost the social unrest key. It created divisions within the Democratic Party, costing the contest key.
Yes. Well, I kind of had a bit of another related question to the importance of keys, even though they are weighted. Has never been wrong in the times in which the popular vote and electoral college are on the same page. Now, the years that it was off, they did match each other, 2020 and 2016, I guess you got one right, you look at one way, and it was only you, I guess, take this, although still.
David, yes. you're dropping off.
David, we're losing you, buddy.
Okay. I don't know if you can hear me. You broke up a bit there.
It's almost split elections.
Yeah.
David,
so,
you'll have to
first,
replace yourself.
Yeah,
when
sorry,
I first developed.
Whitman.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, I was just asking about the split election. Sorry about my audio if it dropped. About split elections and if the keys, or if there's certain keys that impacted those races more than others.
Yeah, I explained that no one key has any more impact than any other. They're all weighted one. There are 13. They gauge the strength and performance of the White House party, and they work in concert. If I tried weighting them, I would create errors, because weighting has to be based upon previous elections, and weights change, creating errors. But it's possible that one key could trigger other keys. For example, the Vietnam War triggered Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president, to withdraw from the election, costing the Democrats the incumbency key. It cost the social unrest key and divisions within the Democratic Party, costing them the contest key.
Yes. Well, I just want to know about the current election or maybe the past two or three elections. But I know that I found it fascinating. You went back and looked at past elections from history. When you did that exercise, what were some of the most interesting elections regarding the keys and what made those elections so interesting within your model?
Yes. The first prediction I made was in the April 1982 Washingtonian magazine, more than 2.5 years before the 84 election, in which I predicted the reelection of Ronald Reagan, which you may say, oh, that was easy. But that was a very daunting prediction at the time, because America was in the grip of the worst recession at that point since the Great Depression. Ronald Reagan's approval ratings were in the dumps, and everyone was talking about a one-term election. Of course, my most controversial prediction was the prediction of Donald Trump as a winner in 2016, which went against all the polls and all the pundits, but I had six keys out against the Democrats, enough to predict their defeat. It had nothing to do with Donald Trump. Any generic Republican would have won, and the fatal sixth key was precipitated by Bernie Sanders challenging Hillary Clinton, which turned the contest key against the incumbent Democrats. And, of course, it was an open seat, so you didn't have the incumbent running, and that cost them the incumbent key as well.
Yes, well, that is fascinating. I'm going to pass it to Tim and then Catherine for some more questions.
Good evening, Dr. Lichtman. Thank you for being with us.
Certainly.
You have mentioned that President Biden is shaky on four of your keys. And the one that concerns me the most is that deals with third party. If RFK Jr. gets over, say, 5% of the vote, would that count more against the incumbent or against Donald Trump?
Great question. As I explained in my book, and the eighth edition of the book is coming out in 2000, this year in July. Also, catch my live show where I track the keys every Thursday at 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. on YouTube. You can catch it according to the hashtag at Alan Lichtman YouTube. Now, I explain that third-party key, unless it's a clear split within the opposition, always counts against the White House party for several reasons. First of all, it's a sign of discontent with the governing of the White House party. Otherwise, you wouldn't get a significant third-party candidate. And it's another voice of criticism against the White House party. Now, as you say, the candidate's got to get at least 5% of the vote for that to count. I obviously don't know that in advance. So I have the Lichtman rule of thumb based upon the wasted vote syndrome. We love you, RFK Jr., but we know you can't win, so we're not going to vote for you. So I take the polling levels and cut them in half. I don't take them at face value. So the candidate has to be polling at least at 10% consistently. And so far, RFK Jr. is all over the map. I've seen him as low as 3% and as high as 15%. So there's been no stabilization yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't seem to be a huge fan of political polls. And you caution against paying too much attention to them. Why is that?
I'll explain that. First of all, early polls, like polls now, 6 months before the election, have no predictive value whatsoever. But generally speaking, polls are snapshots. They are not predictors. They are abused as predictors. Even late polls have proven to be inaccurate. Finally, the error in the polls is much larger than they would have you believe. You've seen this. They always say our error margin is randomly plus and minus 3%. But that's just statistical error. That's the error you would get if you took a sample of red and green balls out of a huge jar and estimated the percentage of red and green balls. But human beings are not red and green balls. They may not have focused on the election yet. They may lie to pollsters. And most critically, no one's voted. So they don't know who the likely voters are. They have to guess at it, and that introduces additional error. So the error is much greater than plus and minus 3%, and it's not random. And given how close elections are, the error in the polls is greater than the margins in voting.
Mm-hmm. Final question, then I'm going to send it over to Catherine. At what point or what makes you decide in every election cycle, okay, these keys are not going to change, the trends are in, and I'm going to make my prediction right now? How do you come to that conclusion?
It's a great question, and it varies from election to election. Sometimes the keys fall in place early, like in 1982. I saw Ronald Reagan losing only three keys, and I didn't see where three more keys would fall. In the very hard-to-call election of 2012, I called it in 2010, also more than 2.5 years ahead of time, because, again, I saw only three keys coming against the reelection of Obama, and I couldn't see more keys falling. However, in 2016, I called it in September of the election year, you know, much later, because the keys did not fall into place until late. So it varies. This time, I have not yet made a final prediction. I expect to make it about the same time I made my 2020 prediction in August. That prediction was fairly late as well, because the pandemic of 2020 changed everything.
And what's making it late this year? Is it the closeness of the race?
Well, several things. One, you know, definitively Biden is down two keys. The mandate key, because they lost House seats. The incumbent charisma key, because he's no Franklin Roosevelt. But there are there's a lot going on, you know, and there are four keys that are shaky. We talked about third party. Social unrest, which I thought was locked. And I still don't think it'll turn, because I think the protests seem to be fizzling, but that is at least in play. And, of course, both foreign policy keys, success and failure, are in play, depending on what happens in the Middle East and in Ukraine.
Right. Well, I appreciate it, Dr. Lichtman. And with that, I'm going to send it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate it. This is really fascinating information. I'm looking forward to your book.
All right. And check out my live show.
Yeah, I will check out the live show, too. Do you ever evaluate the keys and consider if there's something that you need to adjust in the keys or add a key or remove a key? I know that makes it hard historically, but are there keys that you'd like to consider? I'm thinking of like healthcare or abortion or whatever. Does that ever happen?
Now, first of all, the reason I don't do that is the system is very robust. It's based on history, but based on very extensive history. Retrospectively, it goes all the way back to the election of Abe Lincoln in the horse and buggy days of politics in 1860 and prospectively since 1984. So it spans 160 years of American history. But every 4 years, someone asks me a smart question like you did. You know, we have an African-American running for the first time. Do we have to change the keys? We have a woman running for the first time. Do we have to change the keys? So we have social media or, you know, Donald Trump sitting on the criminal dock. And my answer is, A, the system has undergone enormous changes and not been altered. And secondly, you can't change a model on the fly. That is a recipe for error.
Okay. And I also guess that these keys sort of incorporate a lot of what changes, you know, the social unrest, whatever, those are all
exactly
incorporate a lot of what we're talking about here.
And that's why I have 13, because they incorporate so much: foreign policy, domestic policy, elections, charisma, social unrest. They're all in there.
Right. Are you ever not so much current, because I imagine you have to sort of keep your surprise to yourself, but in reviewing historically, were there any surprises that you found?
Well, the biggest surprise is the irrelevancy of the popular vote. When I first developed the keys in 1981, you had to go all the way back to the 19th century, to 1888, before you had a divergence of the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. But really, in the last few decades, the popular vote has become irrelevant. The Republicans, in the last 30 years, have only won the popular vote once, in 2004, and yet they won the presidency in 2000 and 2016. And the reason is, in just two states, New York and California, the Democrats pile up 5 million or so extra popular votes, which count for zero in the Electoral College. They could win those states by 537 votes, like Bush won Florida in 2000. So I only call winners. I don't consider the popular vote because it's not predictive of anything anymore.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. I'm going to send it back to David for any final questions. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yes. Well, Dr. Littman, we thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. And you, of course, told us about your book. You told us about the live show, which, honestly, I've done research on you, booking you for the show and everything else, and I did not even know about that. So share both of those with our listeners one more time before you leave us tonight.
Okay. It's every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, D.C. time, on YouTube, and you can catch it by looking at Alan Lichtman YouTube. And we've already racked up 6,500 subscribers, so we're getting a good showing.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for coming on tonight and all the work you're doing, and we're going to keep watching, and maybe down the road we can be so honored to have you on again.
You know where to find me. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you,
sir.
Good night.
Good night. All right, that was Dr. Alan Lichtman, The 13 Keys. Sounds like that was news to all of us on that show, and I bet I know what we're going to be doing on either Thursday nights or Friday mornings, because that's the beauty of YouTube. You can watch things around your schedule. But I'm going to probably start checking in on that coming soon. How about you, Catherine and Tim?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we will see, but it was fascinating to hear about that and talk to Dr. Lichtman. And y'all did have some great questions. He was very happy with some of y'all's thoughtful queries. But perfect time, and we got through a lot of our topics. He called in, and now – we're at the end of the, top of the hour. And next week, we've got another great guest coming on the show from CBS News. He actually had an interview with Courtney Cox this morning. But Jonathan Vigliotti from CBS News is going to come on the show. And what he's going to talk to us about is his book on climate change and environmental too late. And he just came up with this book recently. I've listened to it. It talks about the wildfires, the flooding, all of the climate crisis issues that are being felt all across the world. And in particular, a lot of these are in small-town America that they're seeing these impacts. And he tells some stories there. So Jonathan Vigliotti will be our guest next week. Before we take a little two-week summer hiatus. I guess you got to get ready for that debate schedule that got announced. But until next week, it's been the Cousy Grind.
Good night, guys.
Good night, y'all.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.